Hi, everyone. This is Kyler from Feeding Matters. Coming to you on August 22nd is the 2025 Feeding and Eating Psychology Summit. This year, we're going deeper. We're hearing from more professionals. In fact, we're going to hear from all four domains of PFD, as well as the two domains from ARFID. And we're going to look across the lifespan, starting with neonatology and going all the way to adulthood. Most importantly, we're highlighting the lived experience. So if you want to come together with other professionals who are engaged and dedicated to serving families and children who struggle to eat while hearing from those families directly, this is your opportunity. We'll see you on August 22nd.
Presented by Feeding Matters with hosts Jacqueline Peterson and Dr. Haley Estrom.
Feeding does matter.
Hey everyone, welcome to Feeding Does Matter. My name is Jacqueline Peterson, and I am here with Dr. Haley Estrom, my co-host. Hi, Haley.
Hi, Jacqueline. How are you today?
Doing pretty well. It's the middle of the week, so just trying to kind of chug along. How are things on your end?
I mean, it's okay, but there's a pretty loud thunderstorm happening outside. So if you hear some rumbling, it's the great outdoors.
It's super sunny over here and super hot in Arizona, so totally different. But I guess our audience can play along and see if they hear any thunder during our conversation.
Yeah, that's just weather in Wilmington.
Weather in Wilmington, that's fair. Our guest today is one of the guests that we've been waiting a long time to be able to talk to because she has so much that's integral to our work. So I will let you introduce our guest.
Yes, and I am so excited for our guest today. As you said, this is Dr. Kathleen Knaffel. I call her Kathy, but she is a professor emerita from the University of North Carolina and at Chapel Hill. And I have known Kathy since fall of 2009 when I was in the family theory class. And I was also in the family way. I was pregnant with my second son at the time. And I started learning about family nursing research with her in that course. And it was a wonderful start to my journey as, you know, just learning about family nursing research. And I've loved it ever since. I'm really looking forward to this conversation today with her on the podcast, and we're just really glad to have you here, Kathy.
Why, thank you. I'm happy to be here. And then I had the good fortune of Haley inviting me to be a member of her dissertation committee as well.
Yes.
Oh,
yes.
Fair. Well, it's so great to have you, Kathy. Thank you for coming.
Sure.
Yeah, I get all excited about talking about when I got to meet Kathy. But yes, she was on my dissertation committee. And then we have worked together on multiple studies involved with feeding since then. And so,
yeah, Haley was my introduction into family research related to feeding. I did a lot of things with chronic conditions, but not feeding problems.
Yeah. So my first question for you, Kathy, would be, could you just start with telling us a little bit more about yourself and how you got started into research with families of children with chronic conditions?
I'd be happy to do that. So I actually, I got into family and particularly family nursing research kind of by accident. So just in it, you know, how you just, your careers can come together in interesting and unexpected ways. And I was a graduate student in sociology, and one of my professors was teaching a course in statistics, and Haley knows most of my work has been in research design. It was first research design. And he at University of Illinois at Chicago. And he was a sociologist, and he decided he didn't have time to teach the course anymore. And so he said he would pay me, this is back probably in the early 80s, he would pay me $50 a lecture to teach the course. And which at the time just seemed like a lot of money.
Yeah.
And And he also said, I don't believe I did this, guys, but sometimes you just jump in and do it, right? So he also said, I don't think there's any reason we need to tell the dean about this arrangement. He literally said, why don't you just kind of, he says, there's a back door, just kind of go in the back door. Here's where the class meets. And I did that for two semesters before he taught.
Go in the back door.
Oh my gosh.
He gave a 3-hour lecture a week, did the paper, did everything. And then he did talk to the dean, and I got hired at that point to teach both research design and statistics. And Haley's smiling because she knows I do a lot of qualitative, you know, different kind of research, to teach the course. And that was my segue into nursing.
Okay.
And so the segue into qualitative in family was really through another nursing, a subsequent nursing dean. I was still working on my PhD in sociology. And the dean at that time had a PhD in sociology and was a qualitative researcher. And she was also a psychiatric nurse, master's prepared psychiatric nurse, but she had an interest in family. And so given we kind of connected and given, you know, the overlapping interest, she actually invited me to contribute a chapter, a couple chapters in a book she was writing. It was a series of qualitative studies of families across the life cycle. And get this, guys. The chapter I was supposed to write, I was much, much younger at the time, was planning the wedding. And it was, I did all these interviews, but the chapter focused on couples got so engaged in planning the wedding, they let the kind of the relationship didn't continue to develop. So it was not the greatest thing for sure I've ever written. But so the book came out. And then Helen Graves, this dean, was very interested in creating partnerships between students in her PhD program, faculty, and clinicians around the city of Chicago. So this is, and so she arranged, I got part of my time bought out by Shriners Hospital, where the nurse, head of nursing there, wanted to, and this is, remember, this is back in the 80s, so this is a very forward-looking nurse, wanted to create the database for family-centered care. And so I was off and running after that point, although, and she also hired somebody who's remained a long-time friend and colleague, Janet Dietrich. Janet Dietrich was in the PhD program at the time, and she hired her to run the research office. So, and Jan and I were supposed to create the database for family-centered care.
Okay.
We didn't have a clue what we should do. We really didn't. So, you know, we started, and this was when Shriners Hospital was called Shriners Hospital for Crippled Children. And there were the guys in fezes walking around.
Right.
You know, all that. And so we started out, as you do, looking at the literature and definitions of family-centered care. And we had, and it was a good insight, we thought, you know, all these definitions come from clinicians. None of them come from families.
Yeah.
And that puzzled us. And so we started just doing some interviews and observations with families and started collecting some data to sort of get an idea what, from the family's point of view, would family-centered care look like. And at that particular Shriners facility, they specialize in children with osteogenesis imperfecta, brittle bone disease. These were these children that just had multiple, I mean, they might be born with multiple fractures. And so Jan, and we did develop some, you know, some materials and did some work with some of the staff there. But so it was a really good experience and got me totally hooked on doing family research and sort of understanding just how much you could learn from families and that family-centered care should be grounded in what families think family-centered care. And by the way, that varied a lot across families too, you know, from I want the clinicians to make all the decisions. I'm not in a position to do that, to I want to make all the decisions or co-decision, do it together. But the other thing that came out of that early work that kind of got us in a little bit different direction was when we were doing observations and talking with families and talking with the physicians and nurses, the physicians and nurses would often express concern that families were saying, sure, she's got osteogenesis imperfectas in a wheelchair and this, that, and the other, but we just see her as a normal kid. And you know what they were thinking? The clinicians, they were thinking the parents are in denial. So, and we're raising concerns about the parents being in denial and not understanding the seriousness of the situation. And that's something that I mentioned it in some of the more recent work we've done, that continues to be something we will see, that this, when families continue to have a more hopeful outlook in what clinicians see as a unhopeful situation. I've done stuff with families with children with cancer. The clinicians don't understand that the families can hold those two different views. They can have a realistic view of the seriousness. At the same time, they can have a hopeful view of what life holds for them. Mm-hmm. So Dan and I, but from that, we ended up, that was when we did Ann Haleniosis, began the work on normalization, that there was a difference between normalization and families' capacity to create what for them seemed like a pretty normal family life. And that was different than denial. They weren't in denial. They were just rebuilding the new normal. So as I said, that was when, that got me very grounded in nursing research in the School of Nursing. And so I started out in sociology. My whole academic career has been in nursing. And I would see why I've certainly done, and particularly early on, a lot of qualitative research. I would see myself as a family. You know, if you said, what do you do? I'd say, not that I do qualitative research, but that I do, you know, family research. And as Haley knows, I am now a big fan of mixed methods research, where you combine the quantitative.
Where you kind of do both.
Yeah, where you kind of combine the, which is what we're doing on this project we're working on now.
Yeah.
So that's how I got into it, kind of by accident. But I think that's, maybe there's a good lesson in that too, just kind of take advantage of some of these.
Yeah.
These situations where you think, well, I don't exactly know what I'm doing here, but I'm going to forge ahead anyway.
And then get in the back door and then build a career out of it.
Maybe literally.
Maybe. Well, that was, that particular dean, Mary Kelly Mullane's father was like a Tammany Hall politician, old-time Irish politician from New York. I mean, and this woman was just, she was a tough dean.
Interesting.
So yeah, it wasn't until later I realized how inappropriate that was for me to meet, for him to be telling me to come in the back door.
Yeah.
Well, you've demonstrated your competence.
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow. And was it the family management style framework that came from that work on normalization?
Yes. So Jan and I started being interested in normalization as a way families often respond to a health challenge in a child. But we knew it wasn't the only way they responded. So that's when we did from qualitative perspective, a pretty large scale study of families with children with different chronic conditions to look at a broader spectrum of the way that they responded, and then different outcomes for the child and different outcomes for the family depending on the response. And that got us into instrument development. And all these years later, we're still, we finally made it to intervention development.
Yep.
That's it.
That's it. You're done. No problem.
Yeah. Career in a nutshell.
Well, what would you say have been some of your most surprising findings along the way?
Yeah, I love that question because I'd thought about that before. Hmm. And which is terrible because we always ask that on the PhD final defense. And that surprised you. But, you know, it took me back to what Jacqueline had written in your last, what was it, the piece you did on the updating on family-centered care, family matters.
Oh,
family.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, you said in that words matter.
They do. Yeah.
And I think, I don't know if it was the, it was both surprising, but it was surprising to me how much they mattered.
Mm.
And that went back to some early work, that the original work we did developing, identifying the different patterns. I can't remember why, but we had an interview question that said, a lot of times you hear the word adaptation and families described as, you know, needing to adapt or having to adapt. What do you think of that word? And parents sometimes, yes, that's the secret. That's what you've got to do. And other parents saying, I hate that word. I'd hate that word. And more recently, Haley, you know what I'm going to talk about, and Haley can give the impact. We started asking in the interviews Haley was doing, can you just talk a little bit about the impact of the feeding challenges on your everyday family life? And some of those, I'm glad they did it early on, but kind of lectured us on, now, you know, it sounds like you're looking for negative things. Or you have to understand the impact isn't necessarily bad. And you changed the wording, didn't you?
Yeah, we changed it around just to talk about, you know, just talk about what it's like or how you spend your time or, yeah, just not to put any sort of value on the time spent, to let them talk about time or work and what it means to them.
Yeah. And I think the other place it came up in my
and work, whether or not it's a challenge. I'm sorry, go ahead. Yeah.
No, but the other time, place, just how much words matter came up in my work when we were developing a measure of family management, how families manage childhood chronic conditions. We had, you know, if you do a good job of developing measures, so this goes back, by the way, Jacqueline, to your statement on family-centered care, there are ways to develop measures that you don't have items that really annoy people.
Yep.
That are offensive. But we were doing these, whether called cognitive interviews, where you show them your draft of questions and they provide the respondents just tell you what they, how they interpret them and what they like or don't like. And we had a number of questions with the word burden. Mm. And we had, I think, every parent saying, no parent, even if they felt that way, no parent is ever going to agree with a statement that says, you know, managing my child's condition is a burden. And so, I mean, that led to some major, that was probably the major, the major changing we did in editing those questions. So when I read that, I thought, oh, I love that statement because words really do matter.
Well, they just carry so much meaning too.
Yeah.
And so if you're really interested in trying to understand a family's experience or trying to understand what an intervention does, you're kind of messing with the results a little bit if it's asking a question that has a lot of negative connotation or a lot of meaning behind it. And
well, and I think that it goes beyond the surveys and the questionnaires, right? Like we need to think about how people are being recruited into interventions and how they're how families are being spoken to while they're in an intervention. And
because it should change care. It's not just changing the research. Yeah,
throughout intervention studies, throughout all types of research, whether it's an online questionnaire or whether they're in treatment, whether they're in telehealth, whatever it is, whatever kind of interaction they're having.
Yeah.
All the words matter, whether they're verbal, written, whatever.
Yeah.
And parents will tell you. I just thought that was in both of, well, throughout those examples, but I was just really struck with some of those early interviews you did, and they just so you know, impact.
Yeah, that was so helpful. I really appreciated them saying those things. And yeah. And, you know, being somebody in that dual role, I mean, I have blind spots too. I didn't see that. I didn't see that coming. So,
And the other one is, you said sort of a surprising thing. This isn't maybe more of a lesson learned than surprising, but the extent to which neither the quantitative measures or the qualitative interviews tell the whole story. And that's why I've gotten so interested in doing studies where you not just collect some qualitative and quantitative, but kind of then for each respondent say, okay, what did we learn from the feeding impact scale, and what did we learn from the interviews? And what we did learn was that you could have, in some cases, a really high score on family on the scale that said high, basically negative impact of feeding on family life. And you'd read those interviews and you'd say, and it was sort of the difference that it didn't have a negative impact. And it was sort of that difference between a measure that gets at these very selected ways in which feeding might influence family life, which measure was perfectly fine on doing that, versus the parent's overall take on the implications of the feeding challenges for family life.
Well, that allows you to almost read between the lines sometimes too, because I know that even when we're trying to understand a family's experience, having other factors considered, it allows you to build the story as much as you can. I agree with you. I don't think you can tell the full story.
Yeah. And that will bleed into what we're talking about, challenges of doing family research, because it does complicate things and lead to the need for greater time and greater resources.
So, if you could address a common misconception about research, is there anything
goes back, Jacqueline, to your statement too, you know, in terms of words matter, this does get kind of back to words matter. So you said, and I just really did want to talk about this, that while researchers, this is related to the surveys, you say you have to keep in mind that researchers are by definition objective.
Oh, yeah.
And parents and patients are by definition subjective. And I said to Haley, and it's not that I read French philosophers, but in one of my methods books, somebody quoted Sartre, the existentialist philosopher.
I don't know.
As saying something along the line that words can be bullets that we shoot at each other. And
that's
it didn't feel that way. But it's just, I think we use certain words to discredit people. So we'll say to families, or sometimes my experience has been, we'll say to somebody who's done qualitative research, yeah, but that's just subjective ideas.
You're right. Yeah. Cause you can dismiss easily in that way.
Then you can just dismiss. And what's subjective about a family member saying, okay, these are the behaviors I see day after day after day. I mean, that's not subjective. That's a sort of reporting of observations. And I think for researchers, I mean, they ask certain questions for certain reasons. Right. A decision to study one thing is sort of by default a decision not to study a whole bunch of other things.
Sure. Choosing to study one thing is saying no to something else.
It's something else. And I think that's based on, it's not necessarily based on objective facts. It's based on values. Yeah. And it may be based on what's good for your career. So I just think
subject. Or funding priorities or many different things.
And I just think it's just the term subjective and objective have kind of lost any, I think, useful meaning actually.
Well, and that's helpful feedback. So thank you for sharing that with me. It's a good reminder that while I was trying to share that words matter, that you don't always.
It was a good example.
Yeah. I put an example right in the letter.
Yeah. And I sort of get what you mean, but I do think it's something that.
Well, it was an oversimplification that didn't show the nuance. And I do think that there are many more nuanced situations than there are clear-cut literal examples. And that's a case of that. Like, it isn't an oversimplification because it is so complex.
I think another maybe misconception, and I don't know that there's much we can do about this, and this is just that I think people find it hard to understand just the whole time frame about doing research.
Oh, yeah.
That's very true.
Moving from you've got the idea to you write the proposal and then you try to get funding and then you try again to get funding and then you got to disseminate and sort of that time span. And I don't know what you do about this, but from the idea to actually changing the world is a long time.
It's even long from when the paper comes out, when you can say this great stuff happened and we found these great findings.
That's true.
And even the timeline from when that happens to when there's any change made is really long as well. So the runway on it is very, very long. And I think that that's maybe hard to understand at first. It was for me. I'm like a fast mover.
Yeah.
Like getting papers out from research that's complete and then once those papers are accepted, like getting them like time of, from accept to publication can also be long.
Yeah. And I think, and getting it to policy change.
Yep. Mm. Yep. Cause you need enough of time in between when it comes out to disseminate, to track that work, to then policy implementation. And then the policy implementation takes a long time too. So that's why this work builds. And that's for me what I was like learning as I've been learning this world a little bit more.
Yeah. I was thinking about, I think another, just one more misconception about research that I think of a lot is that qualitative is not systematic or it's not.
Oh yeah. Talk a little bit about that.
It doesn't have rigor. I think it came up the other day in a meeting and I was like, no, qualitative is systematic. It is a systematic research method. Like, please don't say that.
Yeah, so. I know. I've been in a number of incidents of that, certainly over the course of my career. In fact, one probably fairly recently here, where it was a community-based qualitative study. I was trying to explain, and obviously not very articulately to the, or convincingly at least, to the person who was bringing up the concern about, no, they're really doing this the way they should be doing it, and it does take time. And the response was, well, there's always excuses not to be doing real research. So,
Feeding Matters Infant and Child Feeding Questionnaire was developed as an evidence-based tool to promote early identification of feeding disorders. Developed by internationally recognized feeding experts, this online questionnaire, available in both English and Spanish, can help you better understand your child's feeding differences and needs. Take it online for free today at questionnaire.feedingmatters.org. That's questionnaire.feedingmatters.org. Or type ICFQ in your search bar.
This is our question that we ask everyone. And I think you may have some good ideas for addressing issues with family-centered research. So the one we ask everybody is, what are some challenges and opportunities? We're going to word it a little different for you. You see with family-centered research for pediatric feeding disorder, and what do you think we can do to overcome them?
Yeah, I think, okay, here's, and this is just lessons learned from having done research, family research related to children with chronic conditions. So kind of reflecting back on that a bit. I think this is probably one for pediatric feeding disorders as well, is that it's not condition or disease specific. And I think that contributes to making getting resources, funding more difficult, because so much of our funding, so many funding streams are linked to a specific condition or a specific disease. And if I understand, you know, why you have your definition of pediatric feeding disorder, just like we have our definition of what constitutes a chronic condition, under that there's a lot of different conditions. We get that on stuff we do with cancer as well. So I think that's one specific one. And one way to get around that, I think, is to, if you, you know, to kind of be aware of some of the research and works that's been done about being disease agnostic, and some of the literature that says, yes, these are multiple conditions, but they're making the case for common family challenges across those conditions that aren't condition specific, and maybe trying to sort out what is and what isn't. So that was one. The other one is linking the challenges, of really linking what your outcome or what you see as your deliverable, what it is at the end of the day you want to accomplish, to your source of support, to your funder. What are they going to read the first page of that proposal and say, yeah, this is something we really want to do. And, I don't know. It seems to me over time for us, it's been funders care a lot more about children than families. Hmm. So the way you get around that one is you need to make the case. I mean, we've done a lot of everything. I think we've gotten, when I think about our strategy for getting funded, it has been to show how making things better for families, enhancing families' ability to respond to the condition, to effectively manage the condition, making things better for families is sort of there in the middle, and that makes it better for children. Then I think that's a better way, at least for us, that's been a better way to make a convincing argument. Yeah. It's not that you say, you just say families are important, but they're important on the way to.
Yeah. Well, that kind of goes back to a question I almost had for you, Kathy, was in this work, we started with calling our consortium the Family-Centered PFD Research Consortium. And then as we've been listening to them, they've really shared with us and challenged us to think beyond some of the words and language that we were using in how we describe families and the needs of families. Yeah. And the work that we're trying to do with PFD and ARFID, and their challenge was that it wasn't inclusive of the patient lens and the patient perspective. And, So it was a really good moment of thinking about, like, I think Haley and I originally were like, families is inclusive of patients. We were like, broadly, it makes sense. But then diving deeper into it, we realized we need to make space for the patient in the patient and family work. And so I wonder your thoughts on that, because it's been a learning for us.
Yeah, one of my, I was trying, Larry Fisher, early on read something that said, in this desire and research, because as family researchers, people, we put effort into sort of treating the family as our unit of study, our unit of analysis. And I think it was Larry Fisher who said, you know, in doing that, we sometimes lose the most important component of the family, which is the individual measures. So I'm glad you brought that up, because I think You probably want to be both looking at maybe some family system outcomes, but some family member outcomes as well.
Yeah, I love that, because that even pulls in some of the other perspectives too. If we've talked about like impacts on siblings and other things too.
Yeah. The other advice I'd say is don't forget about synthesis research, pulling together the literature.
Yeah. Tell us like a little bit more basic in terms of what that might be if someone's not familiar with that term.
So just think of literature. Think of a very sophisticated literature review. You know, you do a literature review usually for your proposal that is really geared to, okay, literature that makes the case for these. This is an important thing to study. Sure. But if you do like an integrative review, there's, you know, there's a number of different ways to do reviews. But if you do, a formal piece of synthesis research, integrative review, you really search, you set up criteria for what literature you're going to include in your review. Say, you might say the last 10 years, here's how I'm going to define family. Here's the kind of conditions I'm looking at. So it's like Haley said, it's talking about qualitative. It's a very systematic approach to looking at the literature. And there's a lot of guidelines for doing that.
Yeah. And how do you think that will help us kind of make a difference in the gray area and the challenges that we have in this world?
Well, I would just, you know, and you have to work probably with, I don't know if you have ties with university librarians, research librarians. I think you just want to make sure that you're not reinventing the wheel in some cases.
Yeah.
And so that you're both building on, I think it helps you decide how you can both build on and extend what's already known.
Yeah. Love that.
Yeah.
Thank you so much, Kathy. It's just truly been a pleasure.
Yeah, it's so nice meeting you. And
I know.
Yeah, so.
It really is nice meeting with you and meeting you in general, because it's great. Haley always shares about just, you know, the project she's on. And I know you're on a project that we'll talk about at some point in the future about our longitudinal work.
Talk about it later.
Yeah. Yeah. We'll have you back on, Kathy, to talk about that. Because it's been a pleasure to meet you, and you've really pushed the field to think about this differently. And so it's been great that we've also benefited from having your guidance and perspective in the areas that we're trying to push PFD and the ARFID worlds together and further.
Yeah. Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure for me as well.
Wonderful.
Well, thank you.
Thank you. And bye-bye.